Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. I got news for you. If you thought I don't have to be concerned about all that DEI, CRT nonsense going on at my kids' school, well, let me tell you why you do. And I'm going to give you the numbers to back it up because you're not going to believe what they're doing. The public schools plan to shortchange your kids if they have white skin based on the school's vision of equity, which is very different from equality. Now, you're going to find that outrageous. No, they're not shortchanging white kids. Oh, yes, they are. And I'll tell you where the numbers came from, and I'll cite them from the Portland public schools in this case, although I'm fairly certain that most of the other big city school systems throughout the Northwest are doing something similar. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network for a Wednesday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you disagree with my point of view, you want to question where I got that information, I'm glad to take your naysayer call. And you'll go first in line at 866-439-5277. You can also send emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. Doesn't get much easier than that. Spell it O-N, the way God intended, if you don't mind. We also have EN as a domain name, but we don't use that one as much. And if you want to vote in our poll on X. Now, this is crazy, but the school teachers unions, who now appear to believe that they own your kids as a political sounding ground, they've released a plan for teaching public school kids in the Northwest about Palestine and Palestinians. In other words, a country that has never existed and citizens of the country that has never existed. And much of the world probably wishes about now that the Palestinians did not exist. Most of the neighbors around what they call Gaza and the West Bank, none of them. Egypt doesn't want them. Jordan doesn't want them. Most of the other Arab Muslim countries, they don't want anything to do with the Palestinians. So the question for X today, should government-run schools in the Northwest instruct your kids about Palestine as the teachers' unions plan to do? And they've already released the lesson plan. So you can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X, also on our website at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, this is the charge I'd lay down. People in the Northwest pay just short of $20,000 per student per year on average to teach public school kids. That's how expensive it is. That means 12 years of public school education at current costs comes up just shy of $250,000 per student for a 12-year education. It's an insane amount of funding. And, of course, in both Oregon and Washington, there are constant fights over getting more money for public schools. You'll even hear some sellout Republicans who will say, why, we have to have more money to preserve our excellent public schools. Yeah, the ones where 20% of the kids drop out, half the kids, if not more, cannot read, write, or count. And at least in the state of Oregon, it's written into state law, you can still get a high school diploma even if you don't know reading, writing, and arithmetic. Yeah, those excellent schools. But then take a look deep inside the budgets, and you find out that they stopped doing equal funding, at least in the state of Oregon, and in particular in the city of Portland. And folks who dug into that, a Northwest think tank called Cascade Policy Institute, I've known their work for a long time. I consider it solid. They drew this information from the Portland public schools, but I'd be willing to bet that if we took a look at Eugene or Salem Kaiser, even if we went north of the river, if we went to Seattle or Spokane, do you imagine you'd find the same kind of allocation, all in the name of equity? Now, let me tell you how it works. Cascade Policy Institute says the Portland Public Schools Board of Directors allocates school funding on the basis of student race and household income as part of its equity funding strategy. And you say, well, how much difference could there be? Let me give you an example. Rosa Parks Elementary gets the most money of any elementary schools in the Portland Public Schools. Rosa Parks is budgeted at $17,891 per student per year. You say, okay, well, what about over at Richmond Elementary School, which is in a more affluent, more white neighborhood with a higher income? Well, they get $10,000 per student less. I'm not exaggerating. $17,891 at Rosa Parks Elementary. At Richmond, $7,649. In other words, the white kids get about $10,000 less per student per year for education. And you say, well, maybe that's just two of the schools. I mean, Portland has more than 100 schools if you total up all the elementaries and the middle schools and the high schools. In middle schools, Harriet Tubman, predominantly students of color, $14,625 per student. How about West Sylvan in a much more affluent and much whiter neighborhood, $8,634. A difference of about $6,000 per student per year. For the top high schools, 10 of them, 10 high schools in the district, funding tops out officially at $15,812. $15,812 per student per year at Jefferson High School, predominantly students of color. Grant High School, about half that, $8,109 per student. Now, what Cascade Policy has done, they've looked at the official numbers from the Portland Public Schools, and they've said, how did this happen? Well, about 13 years ago, they point out in 2011, the school board said, we're going to take out the idea of equally funding all schools and all students, and we're going to replace the word equal with equity. And how much difference does that make? As they say, the policy means that schools with a higher percentage of what they call, because they want to camouflage what they're doing. I mean, racial segregation for funding of schools seems like it might be illegal, unconstitutional, immoral, and a whole bunch of other bad things. But they say historically underserved students. So they use a term that most people are going to look at and say, I'm not even sure what that means. Historically underserved students would receive larger allocations of funding. As I pointed out, at the high school level, almost twice as much money, depending on what color the students are and whether or not the district, that part of the district, because this is all one big district. So if the Portland Public Schools tell you we fund all of the kids' education equally, that's a big fat lie. So they don't say it. We fund it based on equity. They say the phrase underserved is a euphemism for discrimination based on race and income. I mean, Joe Biden, remember how he objected as a U.S. senator to jungle schools? He'd love this policy. Students who are Black, Hispanic, Native American, and Pacific Islander automatically qualify as underserved, even if they come from wealthy families. Even if they have a family with a strong academic background, they are considered to be underserved. And how do you determine that they're underserved? Color of the skin. That's how they do it. Now, Portland Public Schools does not have a proud tradition when it comes to race. It is an ugly tradition, an ugly history dating back a long, long time. But now they're saying if your kid is white, your kid is going to go to a school that doesn't get nearly as much money as schools that are populated with predominantly children of color. If anybody thinks that's a great idea, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call. 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails, talk@LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. I know a lot. With...
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sick.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
The most basic job of government at all levels is keeping Americans safe. Governments fail in the Northwest to perform that mission. They fail miserably, even when they have the tools to get it done. Jared Walter, already a convicted sex offender, is back in a courtroom facing new charges. This criminal sexual freak poses real danger to women, and yet the system provides a revolving door for him to just go in and go right back out again. Walter has a long rap sheet, and it certainly doesn't help when reporters slap a cute nickname on a pervert like this. The TriMet barber suggests he's more of a curiosity than a threat. Cutting snippets of hair off women on buses and trains got him literally banned for life from Portland's failing transit system. The only person to be banned for life from transit. Now an indictment accuses him of taking video of women using a public toilet at Portland Community College. The inability to control this deviant is in itself an indictment of Oregon's so-called criminal justice system at every level. Lack of policing on trains, cowardice of the courts to actually lock the bad guys up, judges who won't do their jobs, and of course, lame duck DA Mike Schmidt for brains. At least the voters rejected him last week. If elected politicians who enjoy taxpayer-funded security for themselves, usually armed security, refuse to protect the public from the depraved, then it's reasonable to question, why do the rest of us have to follow the law? Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Couple of questions of the day. Number one, this is insane, Lars. New York Judge Mershon just told jurors they do not have to unanimously agree on what crime Trump is guilty of. It could be a 4-4-4 split. Yep, that's the way Judge Mershon rolls. And question number two, Terry writes in, Lars, where do we gather to loot, burn, and pillage downtown Portland if Trump is found guilty? And would anybody actually notice if we did that? Signed, Terry. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to former governor of Oregon, Kate Brown. She set free a criminal who has now been indicted on three killings. Jesse Lee Calhoun, charged with second-degree murders of Charity Lynn Perry, Bridget Leanne Webster, and Joanna Speaks. He's accused of killing these women in a three-month period between March and April of last year. A short three-month killing spree is what he's accused of. Many years ago, Jesse Calhoun got a light sentence for assault and kidnapping a woman. He was later rearrested for attacking a police officer and auto theft, and again given a light sentence and then an early release from Governor Brown. Former Governor Brown now, thank God. Brown gave Calhoun an early release for helping out with the prisoner wildfire program. He's now been rearrested a third time and is allegedly tied to the deaths of four women. An indictment for three of those women victims occurred this month. Calhoun became the face of Oregon's early release failures and then Governor Brown's early release of more than 1,000 criminals during her tenure. The Taxpayers Association of Oregon has been active in reporting on Brown's tragic soft on crime campaign. Today's best email, but you can always send more, is brought to you by Window Nation's semi-annual sale. Now on 50% off, no interest for 5 years. Call 866-90-NATION or visit windownation.com. Send those emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Scott writes in, Lars, I was listening to Robert De Niro's comments about Trump yesterday. I was not angry. I was just thinking De Niro's in a different world. Totally. Here's a guy who's got a net worth of over $250 million. He's got attendants serving his every need. The reality of his life is utterly divorced from the reality that most Americans face. His comments did not resonate at all. I felt pity for him. Signed, Scott. To your calls at 866-439-5277. Let's start with Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I was wondering, you know, so these schools like Rosa Parks and whatever, elementary and all these Harriet Tubman, they get extra money, right?
Yep,
so
they
where
do.
Where does the money go? Where, because presumably,
flushed,
I mean, I
down
could
a toilet?
Make a big assumption, but yeah, because those schools if they're in underserved neighborhoods and they're not brand new schools, and it's not like they're giving the kids more school books or tutors or anything. So really the funding goes to the administration as always, right?
No,
so,
mostly, well, some to administration, and I would agree with you wholeheartedly if you said we spend too much on administration. Absolutely right. 85% of the cost of government-run schools is salaries and benefits. The other 15% is everything else, maintenance and the books and computers and floor wax and light bulbs. So 85% goes to salaries. I agree with you. Portland Public Schools is a terrible situation. They have over 8,000 employees, and less than half that number are teachers. And in fact, here's a piece of math. This one's kind of crazy. I know doing math on the radio is not the best thing in the world, but think about
racist,
this.
Lars.
If what's that?
I said math is racist. Don't you know
that?
Yeah,
math. I know 2 + 2 equals 5 and all that. You're absolutely right about that. But think about this. If you take if you were looking at a school and you said, how many people do you have here? And they, well, over 8,000. Well, how many of those are teachers? Less than half. Does that make sense, just for starters, that less than half the employees of a school district that teaches kids are actually teachers?
It's unbelievable, actually.
Okay.
It's completely laughable.
Let me make it worse. If you take that number of teachers, the minority of the employees of the district, so less than 4,000 are teachers, and you divide it by the number of students, do you know what number you get? 16-1. And you say, that's a darn good ratio, 16 kids for every teacher. You say, so how many teachers or how many students are in the average classroom with each teacher? I say 23. You say, hold on, you have enough teachers to have 16-1 classrooms if you used all your teachers for teaching, but you only have a ratio of 23-1 in the classroom? Where do the other 50% go? And you say, well, they're on other assignments. So that's how bad it gets. And then consider Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, the one I mentioned. The student teacher ratio is damn good. I mean, it's close to private school. It's 13-1. Meaning you've got an average of one teacher for every 13 kids. So to the extent that when you get down to very low teacher student ratios like that, you should get some fantastic results. Do you know how Rosa Parks comes out when it comes to reading, writing, and math? Crap results.
Oh, I'm sure it's in the bottom. Yeah.
It's terrible. And you say, but you have a lot of money, you have a lot of personnel, you have a great student-teacher ratio, and you say, why isn't it working? It's because, Jeff, if you walked into any business, there are a number of big business types that have this rule. You walk in, and you say, who are the 10% least worthwhile employees here, the ones that are doing us the least good? And you fire them. And then you hire good ones, even average ones, to replace them. You automatically boost the performance of that company. But what can't you do in the schools? You can't fire the dead wood. The teachers' unions won't allow it. They say, these people are here for the duration. And if you don't like them, just better get used to them, because you can't get rid of the bad ones. You would in a private sector entity like a private school. You cannot in the public schools. And that's part of why they produce such lousy results. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program and the Radio Northwest Network. I got to tell you something. I don't know if my friend Aaron Mesh, who's managing editor at Willamette, will agree with me or not, but it sounds like Northwest governments that have just been throwing money, throwing hundreds of millions of dollars a year in both Oregon and Washington at the problem of drug treatment, alcohol treatment, homelessness, the whole nine yards. They're opening up a gigantic opportunity. If you thought those Nigerian princes got a lot when they, you know, scammed Jay Inslee for $600 million from the unemployment fund, I think this one's going to make that one pale by comparison. And Willamette has written about it recently at WWeek.com. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here. And actually, yes, I would agree with that characterization more or less.
I mean, because I always imagined that when they said, say, Multnomah County's going to throw $250 million at something and Puget Sound's going to throw, you know, $250 million a year at this, that they'd say, well, let's go out and find programs with a good track record of success and see if we can just expand them because they can expand because we have the money to help them expand. This sounds like anybody who can put a cell phone number up and fill out an application is going to be able to create some of these so-called programs, even if there isn't really very much behind them at all. Am I wrong in that impression?
So let's just back up a second and talk a little bit about the context here, which is
sure, I'm sorry.
A week ago, Multnomah County officials sent out an alert saying, a fraud alert saying that a scam company had arrived in town claiming to run a sobering house or a sober house as part of their drug and alcohol treatment clinic, and that they were recruiting homeless people from the shelters and we helped them get clean, then having them sleep on the floor of a living room in Gresham. Now, how much of that actually happened remains incredibly unclear. And partly it's unclear because Multnomah County sent out without ever actually investigating the claim that the fraud was happening. And the claim came from a rival drug and alcohol recovery treatment program that easily could have been exaggerating the story because of, you can imagine what their motivation for exaggerating might be.
I mean, this is headhunting. If you fill a building or a room with people, then I guess you get money from the county. Is that the way it works in very simple terms?
In very simple terms, yes. So, and there's no question that the reason why Multnomah County had its was hair trigger on this was because the recruiting that you're describing is definitely happening. Now, whether or not this particular company that's featured in this story was guilty of doing this is very much an open question. But the larger ecosystem here, the larger environment that's been created by the enormous number of federal and state public dollars for drug and alcohol treatment means that companies are arriving in town, sometimes from out of state, literally recruiting people who have drug and alcohol treatment addictions, as if they were like, there's this company called Rodeo Recovery down in California that was telling, this is to me the craziest part of the story, that last August was stationing itself outside of homeless shelters in Portland, putting out flyers saying, we will give you free airfare to Beverly Hills to get sober. So we're going to send you down to Beverly Hills to dry up.
By the way, in luxurious surroundings, right?
Well, sure, that it looked like luxurious surroundings, although the reality is that California officials have accused companies down there of essentially running fentanyl houses where people were still using and living in squalid conditions. It did not exactly have the Rodeo Drive, Beverly Hills quality that was being advertised, right? So, like, yep. To be clear, no homeless people in Portland are getting, like, the luxury spa treatment anywhere. That's not what's happening. What's happening is that exploitative companies are arriving in the city claiming to have, like, a nice recovery facility or, you know, what we used to call rehab, claiming to offer fancy rehab and, in fact, like, putting people in conditions that make even the streets of Portland look good by comparison.
So I could rent out my living room and do this. So, Aaron, just let's give credit to Lucas Mansfield, the reporter on this. But one of the craziest things I thought was you keep saying companies, but in at least one of the cases, you've got a guy using his own personal cell phone as the number for the business. And then is it a different guy who has the history in Arizona where the same kind of thing was done, except they disappeared after not paying the bills and split town and came to Portland instead? When you say company, are we talking about one guy with a cell phone and a letterhead or what?
Yeah, probably in some cases. Like, it's super fly-by-night. But I use companies – the reason I'm using companies rather than the catch-all of nonprofits is because it would appear that most of these are, in fact, registered as for-profit LLCs. So they're not part of the nonprofit industrial complex, so to speak.
Okay, that's often a good distinction.
The term is often bandied about. Like, they are in this to turn a profit is their stated motivation, which is the only reason why I keep saying companies. I mean, you could describe them as individuals or other less savory terms, I'm sure. One of the things that I think is really important is that it's very hard for anyone to figure out exactly who's doing what. And yes, it's certainly possible for you to allow that. Just open up your living room and say, my living room is now your bedroom. And, you know, in my living room, maybe. Or maybe you'll just, like, stay addicted in my living room. And you can do that in part because the state does not, despite handing out all this money, does not mandate certification for sober homes. So opening a sober home does not require a state license. You can just open one and say, this is my sober home.
Now, hold on. How do you get the money, though? Do you just go to the state and say, by the way, I've got a sober home. I had a dozen people there last night. Now give me my cash. How does that work? Because the story didn't explain.
I think Lucas could explain this better than I can. We had a bunch of graphs in the story that we cut because we didn't have enough space for them.
But see, that's what editors do. This is why everybody curses editors, Aaron. I hate to tell you that. But
well, not only do the editors cut all the good stuff, we also don't actually understand all the good stuff necessarily, which is why I'm going to, like, beg to not explain how the money mechanism works. But I will tell you that it tends to be, the way Lucas described it to me is that it tends to be like a kind of Medicaid fraud where it's like by individual. So the state or the feds are subsidizing the individual, and then the individual's like having the money paid back to the homes. So it's not like they're handing the money straight to the homes. It's like we pay.
Oh, they're handing the money to fentanyl addicts. Is that it?
I don't think it's quite like
that.
I think it's
what could possibly go wrong.
Like, you document how many fentanyl addicts you have on your living room floor, and then they pay you by the number. So, I think it works like that, to my understanding. But again, I'm confident the people who understand it better than me are going to say I just got all of that wrong, because it's not the part that I put in the story.
Well, the other part of context is, Aaron, am I right in saying that most of these governments, both sides of the river, are absolutely desperate to spend this money? Because hundreds of millions of dollars was budgeted to deal with this problem. And then the question began to be asked of entities like King County and Multnomah County. Hey, you got this pile of money. Have you spent it? Well, no, we haven't. So there's a desperation on their part that if they don't spend the money, they're going to have to tell the voters, we've always complained that lack of money was the reason we couldn't solve the problem. Then you gave us a pile of money. We couldn't figure out how to spend it. And that's why we're not solving the problem, because we're incompetent.
I think you have described the catch-22 that a lot of regional governments find themselves in when it comes to drug and addiction treatment services and homeless services. If they don't spend the money, they are seen as laggards. If they do spend the money without any kind of side rails on it, then they are seen as profligate. So,
or they could just say, come to us with your program, show us what it is, tell us what we should expect that you're going to accomplish if we give you some money, and then we'll start doling money out, and based on your performance, we'll either give you more or cut you off. Is any of the government doing that?
It doesn't seem that way to me.
Yeah. You got to read the story. It's Lucas Manfield's story at WWeek.com, and I guarantee you it's being duplicated in every ridiculous town in the Northwest. And if anybody knows otherwise, I'd love to hear about the program that actually works, actually expanded, actually put the taxpayers' money to some good use. It's Wednesday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson. You know, for
broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours, it's Sanitized Entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Before I go to our first naysayer of the day on the Radio Northwest Network, I want to mention this. Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz is out as chief. Apparently the mayor of Seattle is going to hold a news conference about 10 minutes from now. At this point, the Seattle police have hit their lowest staffing level in 30 years. They have lost 700 officers in just the past 5 years. As of the month of March, the Seattle police had 913 actively working police officers. They expect the total number of officers to decrease in the first 3 months of 2024. They are in big trouble, and Portland is no better. They have had people separating, not retiring, but separating, meaning they're leaving Seattle and they're going someplace else. A lot of them are going to law enforcement agencies in Idaho. Consider the implications of that. And then imagine trying to attract new, young men and women, and since it's Seattle, pronouns to work as police officers in the current environment. To our first naysayer of the day, John, welcome to the program. We love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer?
Let me give you a preamble, and then I'll tell you why.
Just not the history of Western civilization, because it'll just burn a lot of daylight. The producers always say, get to your point. What is your point?
What the problem is we have administrators that care more about their job than they do about the welfare of students. The union is beatable. I had 13 grievances against me, and they lost every one. Here's the point. A permanent teacher under the current law and made it stick. And any administrator can do it if they are not afraid about their own existence. If they have the care of the students in mind, it became case law for the law schools. And if you want to check it out,
But John, I'm not sure we disagree. You're saying teachers can be fired. I'm telling you that it is a long, torturous process, not as long on the West Coast as it is on the East Coast. There you've got people who stick around for years. But if you make it hard to fire a bad teacher, is that good for the kids? And that's not the administrator's decision. To a large extent,
yes,
that's the unions. Well, it's the state legislature and the unions.
The union is beatable. It's case law in Oregon, the Peggy Owen case.
Okay, but John, we agree that it is possible. But is it long, torturous, difficult, and expensive to fire a teacher?
No.
You don't think so? You think you can just call a teacher in and say, you're not doing a good job, I'm sending you down the road and hiring somebody else?
That's the short way. You call them in, you assess them, you go in their room, you evaluate them. Every 5 days, I had 25 teachers. I was in your room, so I had data. You have to have data. You can't just
And I wouldn't expect a teacher to be fired on less than data. How many years ago was that, John?
How many what?
How many years ago was your experience?
Oh, let's see, 1990.
So a third of a century ago. Things have changed, John. The unions have made it well nigh impossible to fire bad teachers. And whether you like it or not, you say, well, it's a lack of courage on the part of the administrators. Probably some of it is that. And then you've got a state law that says you can't be a superintendent or an administrator unless you were already a teacher, meaning you've got to have, say you've got 20 years in as a teacher and you want to be a superintendent, you can. If you have not been a teacher, you cannot be a superintendent longer than 18 months in the state of Oregon. Why do you think they made that rule? Because it meant that they would have people as superintendents and administrators who were favorably disposed toward protecting their union friends, even though they're no longer in the union. Does that sound like a good thing for kids?
Well, I suppose people do that. That's not my mentality. No, it's not good for kids. If you're an administrator who has the welfare of the student in mind, all of that you talked about, Lars, can be overcome.
How often, John, in your local school district do you hear about a teacher being let go, not for criminal activity, sexual activity, or other kinds of crimes, but simply because they weren't very good?
If the administrator did the job, they were let go before the...
I didn't ask you that. How often does it ever happen, John?
Well, at least once a year.
One teacher a year?
Yep.
Okay. And if that's the case, good. Let me go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, we're talking about the alcoholics and the addicts on the street. And there was a program many years ago in California that was quite successful. It was called the M2 program. Most of the people will get clean and sober if they have some hope and they have an honest desire. But if they don't have a job, you can stack them in warehouses of these houses that they're starting up where, you know, the people get the money and the people that are there, you know, are living in squalor again, as you talked about. But if you have it to where, they take half of that money and they talk to these companies around here and they pay half the wages and the program of the government pays the other half, and they have a meaningful job where they think they can have some type of future, most alcoholics and addicts will try to stay clean and sober. And it's a
that's
you know,
once
AA,
you get them clean and sober, isn't it? Because but if you go to somebody who's addicted to fentanyl right now, say I'll give you a job, are they going to get off fentanyl? In most cases.
Well, if they had a place to live and they had a good job, I believe that if they worked a program, they'd have to work a program.
I'd love to see that program actually work. Apparently, it's not around in Oregon.
The Lars Larson.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment, but we've got to talk about this. I remember decades ago when the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed at the federal level. And the, you know, at least on paper, it sounded good. Although these days, when I start to see government programs that sound good on paper, I always wonder how long is it going to be before somebody figures out how to turn it into a scam? Well, the ADA has been turned into a scam for a long, long time. I'm not saying that the people who actually deserve the protection of the ADA should not get that protection and that we should treat people with disabilities in a way that accommodates those disabilities. The problem is there are shyster lawyers out there who've decided to use the ADA as kind of a shakedown. A little bit of fee contingent kind of law of, if not law enforcement, at least lawyering. Michael Fuller joins me now, who always bills himself as the underdog lawyer. Michael, welcome back.
Hi, Lars.
You've got a case just like this, and if you're on speakerphone, please pick up so everybody can hear what you're saying. But I want you to describe what's going on as small businesses are set upon by people using the ADA as a shakedown, basically a form of legalized extortion. And if you disagree with that description, tell me why.
No, that's how I see it. I read an article a few weeks ago about these lawyers that were sending out demand letters to largely immigrant-owned small businesses, basically saying, bring your property into compliance with these technical violations and then pay us a bunch of attorney fees or we'll sue you. And I thought, yeah, you know, lawyers are unpopular enough, and now we got these lawyers out there shaking down small business owners. And then 2 days ago, I got put in touch with Han Tran, and Han Tran is an immigrant from Vietnam. She's 61 years old, recovering from brain surgery. She's the type of person, you know, worked three jobs her whole life. And so before the pandemic, she buys this small commercial lot in Southeast Portland. It's got like a nail salon on it and a to-go Thai restaurant. So last month, she gets a letter from this attorney, Jessica Mulligan. And the letter basically says, hey, you know, your property's not ADA compliant. I guess it had some faded paint and there was a sign missing, allegedly. She demands, quote, attorney fees associated with the case. And says, bring it into compliance and pay me these fees, and it's good for 7 days. So this Tran goes out, hires an ADA compliance specialist, pays over $3,000 for supplies, contractors, does it all within 7 days, emails this lawyer and says, hey, we're working on it. We've done all this, but could you let us know, you know, what evidence you have that we weren't in compliance? And, you know, is there a basis for this attorney fee? The attorney responds, quote, I would suggest you make a counteroffer or this will go into litigation. So Ms. Tran never hears back, and then come May this month, she gets a federal court lawsuit. Someone banging on her door with a federal court lawsuit from this lawyer.
And by the way, how much did the lawyer want to settle this up without filing the lawsuit?
Unclear. It just said attorney fees associated with the case. And given that there really is no case yet, I looked at the documents that this lawyer sent with this, what I would call shakedown letter, and it looked to be just copy and pasted requests for documents, a draft complaint that mirrored complaints that this lawyer has repeatedly filed in court over similar things. But it was unclear. We've heard from other local business owners that they've been asked for, you know, upwards of $10,000. And if they didn't pay it, they would get sued by this lawyer.
Okay. And Michael, just so people understand, if you say this is for legal fees, meaning how many billable hours could you attribute to something that is simply filing the complaint and saying you're out of compliance and you can pay our attorney's fees, How many hours could you burn up doing that if most of it is just cut and paste?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that you could spend really any significant amount of time at all. And it's just curious, you know, why the, we call the plaintiff, the person who's this lawyer puts their name on the lawsuit, why they wouldn't just raise the issue with the business attorney, why go straight to this lawyer. And you raise a good point. You know, Oregon law generally does not allow lawyers to share fees with non-lawyers. And Oregon law generally does not allow a lawyer to send misleading demand letters. And so to the extent the demand letters are saying, you know, you're going to be paying us money associated with attorney's fees, and then if that money is later shared as compensation with this client, you know, that could be problematic for this lawyer.
Well, and one of the two lawyers you've named are David Foster and Jessica Mulligan, and I'm going to reach out to them, and I'm going to offer my due diligence is I'll afford them the chance to come on and explain what they're doing. They've brought cases against 35 small businesses since September.
That's what I read in the paper, and I went and looked at some of those lawsuits. The most recent lawsuit was brought for the same individual whose name is on the lawsuit against my client, and what they were suing for wasn't ADA compliance. What they were suing for was apparently a local business had signed their confidential agreement to pay the attorney fees and never did. So not only will they sue you for these purported ADA violations to collect their attorney fees, but if you sign their demand letter or you sign their settlement agreement and you don't pay them, they'll sue you for that too. So it's just unclear what's driving these cases. It seems like a very poor way to go about it. I'm a fan of the ADA. I recently was appointed by a federal judge and did a full federal court trial under the ADA just in February, pro bono, for a woman in a wheelchair. So it's a very, you know, it's very important protections. But I think these lawyers are just giving, you know, civil rights lawyers a bad name by taking this approach.
I'd agree with you. And by the way, credit to the NBC reporter, that's Kylie Boshi, who's actually dogged this as well. So credit where it's due to him. But when you say you're missing the sign, the blue sign with the wheelchair emblem on it, and you haven't painted to the exact technical specs the parking space to make it van accessible, that's what most of these are about?
Seemingly, and some of these requirements, you know, and I'm a trained lawyer and I can't exactly understand even what they're demanding. They're saying things like, you know, the distance between the front door and the front step is less than a half inch, and that it's just, you know, I can't understand even what they're demanding. And so that's why our client talked to her realtor and they reached out in a formal email and tried to get clarification, and this lawyer would have nothing of it. She said, you basically pay me or we're going to sue you, and I'm not inclined to tell you anything more.
So it's as though they want the problem fixed, but they won't describe exactly what the fix is. But if you pay them, the problem goes away. That sounds like garden variety extortion, doesn't it?
It sounds like it to me. And then conveniently, they say, you know, you have to pay us right away. But if you end the agreement, we'll give you up to 120 days to make repairs. Be curious to know how often they actually go back and ensure that the repairs are made. But having talked to local business owners about this, the business owners want to comply with the ADA, but these people are targeting an immigrant population. Their English isn't so good. They're not trained lawyers. And, you know, they're sending these very thin letters. And I guess to their credit, they do follow through on their threats. And they're now clogging our federal court system with these lawsuits that are basically over attorney fees. I mean, our client already made the changes that were asked of her long before this lawsuit was ever filed.
And by the way, your client is Vietnamese, an immigrant to America. So in, say, in Vietnam or other countries around the world, they may be used to government officials showing up and saying, we demand this, we demand that. And they don't know whether they may not be clear on whether or not they have any rights. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And in this case, you know, she never heard back. She assumed it was resolved. I mean, she went out of pocket immediately and had to pay a little extra money to get a contractor out there within a week. And I guess there's a cottage industry of contractors that'll come make you ADA compliant. But yeah, she did everything she thought was required of her. It was a complete shock. And, you know, she's recovering from brain surgery. She's not in a great position to have people banging on her home door, handing her papers. And we agreed to represent her. She got referred to us by another law firm. We do 20% pro bono work. Usually it's representing, you know, disabled people. But in this case, I found
Michael. That's Michael Fuller, the underdog lawyer, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Because
because you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'm warning you 5 months ahead of time. The Democrats have a plan to fill the election rolls this fall, especially in the campaign for president, with illegal aliens and non-citizens. Now, I know a lot of you don't believe me on this, but in fact, we're getting the message loud and clear that the Democrats want illegal aliens voting, and Republicans, for the most part, do not. But let me get into the details of that, and I will quote directly Jamie Raskin, who is one of the most left-wing Democrats in the United States Congress, and he's got a long history reaching back almost a third of a century in writing in favor of allowing illegal aliens and non-citizens to vote. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we are going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X. The poll on X, and the question can be found at Lars Larson Show on X or on our website at LarsLarson.com. This is such a crazy situation. You would think that most Americans hew to the idea that citizens are allowed to vote in America's elections. Non-citizens, even those who are here legally, are not allowed to vote in those elections. And yet you've got the Democrats holding up the naysayer side of that one. So, for example, the House of Representatives has voted this week to prevent foreign nationals from voting in Washington, D.C. elections, because in every other of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama fan, but 50 states for the rest of us in America, in those 50 states, the state legislature controls what the voting rules are. In Washington, D.C., that is controlled by the U.S. Congress. So the House simply voted to prevent foreign nationals from casting a vote. But the Democrats decided that was, and I'll use their words, the big lie. Representative Jamie Raskin, member of Congress and a vocal opponent of the legislation. Now, this is a guy who's a Democrat who says, no, non-citizens should be able to vote. And how strongly does he feel about this? Well, back in 1993, so 31 years ago, Jamie Raskin wrote a paper called Alien Suffrage, in which he argued that non-citizens should be able to vote. The majority of Americans in public opinion polls say non-citizens should not vote in local elections. 75% of the people in public opinion polls done recently say we are against the idea. Only 25% are in favor. And I'd be willing to bet that if you could check the party position of the 25% who are in favor of the idea, I could just about guarantee that they are members of the Democrat Party, maybe independents, maybe libertarians. So Raskin was among 143 Democrats who voted against the bill to ban foreign nationals from voting in D.C. elections. So as you can tell, there are a lot more than 143 Democrats in the U.S. Congress. In fact, it's not quite a Democrat majority, but the Republicans hold a very, very thin majority on Capitol Hill. But still in all, even all Democrats did not vote against the idea. And why? You know what's going on right now. We have seen in the last 3.5 years more than 10 million people illegally cross into America. Those are not my numbers. Those are numbers from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the Border Patrol, part of Homeland Security. And of those more than 10 million, at least 7 million of them have stayed in the United States. And I think for the illegal alien, they know who to be grateful to. They know that Donald Trump has promised the biggest single deportation in American history. And that's saying something if you go back and look at some of the deportations that have been conducted in this country. Now, actually, I don't think you need to deport them. You just need to change the tax laws and tell employers, go ahead and employ all the illegals you want. You can't deduct their wages at tax time, and American businesses will fall into line. But when it comes to the question of voting, can an illegal alien vote? If you look at the letter of federal law, it says no, they can't vote. Not at all. It's a crime. It's actually a felony crime to register. It's a felony crime to cast a ballot. except that the law is not enforced. And that is a choice. It's a choice somewhat of state government, somewhat of the federal government, not to go after people who illegally cast votes in elections. And still, there are, in fact, a lot of cases, thousands of cases in the last 20 years or so that have been brought against people for illegally voting in elections. But it's extraordinarily hard to detect. And now with the advent of vote by mail, it's even harder to detect. How do you know when you look at somebody's name who's registered to vote, how can you tell whether or not they're voting legally or not? Now, if you talk to the elections officials, especially those who have no problem with illegal aliens voting, although they won't say it out loud, and you ask them, how do you know that non-citizens are not voting? And they'll pull out one of the voter registration forms and they'll show it to you. And you say, see, right here, it says if you sign this form and you're not legally able to vote because you're not a citizen, you're committing a crime. Nobody would want to sign that. Well, the fact is, they don't care. And doesn't it make sense to you that they would not care? If you have entered somebody else's country illegally and you have broken the law just to enter, and then once here you start working illegally and you may or may not pay taxes, that's another legal matter. You may commit other crimes. You may drive without a license. You may drive while drunk. You may do a lot of things as an illegal alien. And as we've seen in the last 3.5 years, Joe Biden's invasion of illegal aliens has brought criminals, terrorists, rapists, murderers. Now, am I saying that every single illegal alien is a murderer? No. There is just a disproportionate number among illegal aliens. And I want to warn you about one of the arguments that's used by proponents of illegal aliens. They will say, why, the average immigrant in America is more law-abiding than the average citizen to America. Do you know how they get to that? It is such a sneaky business, because what they want to do is take the crime rate among legitimate immigrants as well as illegal aliens. So every green card holder in America who's come here legally, who's followed the rules, who knows their green card has to be renewed, who knows that if they obey the law, that they may someday take the oath and become a citizen. They want to mix that crime rate in with all the people who just came across the border and said, I don't need no stinking papers to come into the United States. I'm going to come in whenever I want. The rules don't apply to me. By mixing the two together, the easiest way to understand what they're doing is like if I said, well, most pharmacists are law-abiding people. You say, well, Lars, who are you including in pharmacists? Well, I'm including the guy at Walgreens and the gal at CVS. Oh, and the guy selling crack or methamphetamine or fentanyl down on the corner. I'm putting them all in the same bucket and saying the average drug dealer is more law-abiding than the average citizen. Well, if you're only looking at real pharmacists, that's true. If you mix in a bunch of crack and cocaine and fentanyl dealers, yeah, it's still true statistically. It just doesn't make any sense. So what do they plan to do this fall? There are already states who are saying, well, we have to sign all these people up to vote. They're part of motor voter. We have to make sure that they're registered to vote. And once they're registered to vote, if it's a vote by mail state, we're just going to send them a ballot and take their word for it that they signed on the line and weren't committing a crime when they registered to vote and when they cast a ballot. That is the plan to try to get Democrats across the finish line on November the 5th. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Email talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your calls. We'll do that in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. I've got a bias in favor of Taiwan. I was born there, American citizen, but I was born overseas to American parents serving the military. But Taiwan has troubled me because I like the freedom of the Republic of China. That's ROC. That's Taiwan. The PROC, the evil empire now that replaced the old Soviet Union as the evil empire, not so very much. And yet, Taiwan is one of those, I always see it as an exception to the rule. There are all kinds of places on planet Earth where America buys the weapons and gives them to people who want to defend themselves, like Ukraine. In the case of Taiwan, they want to buy their own weapons from us, but then we have to actually deliver. And now the question is, members of Congress have promised weapons to Taiwan to defend against China. Are they going to keep that promise? So I thought I'd put that first to our friend Dr. Weifeng Zhang, who's senior advisor for the Office of Fiscal and Regulatory Analysis at America First Institute. How are you doing, doctor?
Very good. Thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, let's start with a simple question. Do you think Congress is going to come through? And if not, why not, if we've promised to let Taiwan buy weapons from us so they can provide for their own defense?
So Congress is surely eager to make things move faster in terms of the weapon delivery. But I'm not sure, you know, Congress eager, you know, is sufficient, because the problem for the backlog, the United States actually promised to sell Taiwan a lot of weapons going back for years. But the delivery has been very slow, and that has a lot to do with our industrial complex, the supply chain challenges. So I think a lot of that has to be overcome before we can really help arm Taiwan.
I mean, I'm not suggesting that we shortchange our own weapons needs. So it's simply that our industry is not capable of producing the weapons as fast as Taiwan would like to buy them?
So interestingly, I mean, historically, it usually takes a few years for U.S. to deliver weapons sales to foreign buyers. So, the delay for Taiwan is longer than usual, longer than other countries perhaps, and that coincided with the COVID supply chain challenges too. But certainly now, you know, with all these, the war in Ukraine, in the Middle East, and also the Biden administration spending money on, you know, domestic inflation, all this is not helping either.
No, and in fact, is there any way for the weapons producers to actually step up, to meet demand? Because it sounds like we've run our own stockpiles short to supply Ukraine, and now we can't supply everything Taiwan needs. And if Taiwan has the weapons to hold off China, or at least make it expensive for China to try whatever it is they're planning to try, then that makes it less likely that the United States would have to step in if Taiwan can defend itself, right?
Absolutely. So some of the challenges are about processes. Usually it takes time. A lot of time it has to go with the congressional schedule. So lawmakers' eagerness to make that move faster certainly helps. But, it generally just takes time to produce extra weapons that we can sell to Taiwan. For example, probably order, I think, placed during the previous administration was to sell F-16s to Taiwan, right? So but those take, you know, obviously kind of take time to make. And so a big part of the the backlog now that we owe Taiwan in terms of delivery was because the Trump administration was bullish in supporting Taiwan, and the United States agreed to sell Taiwan a lot during those years. But those still have to take time to deliver.
Well, and is it $19 billion we're behind now, or is the number different than that?
19, yeah. It hasn't changed for a few months now. So obviously the movement there is pretty disappointing. But even pre-COVID, like shortly before COVID, the backlog was about 14, 15 billion. So that's already the lion's share out there.
I mean, we buy so much in the way of consumer goods from both mainland China and from Taiwan. You'd think they want to balance that out a little bit by selling Taiwan some of the stuff we're best at making. And we're certainly very good at weapons, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I think to supply for our own defense, the system works a little better than, you know, helping our selling to other countries and helping our allies, which is something that we really desperately need to change. And another thing that needs to move also faster was a lot of the backlog was what we would consider conventional defense weapons. But for Taiwan really to defend against the mainland Chinese invasion, they would need some asymmetric defense weapons, those, I think the United States is not selling enough, not selling and delivering fast enough to Taiwan.
Okay, well, when you say asymmetric, what kind of weapon systems are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about, so if China does decide to invade Taiwan, that would be a very lopsided conflict. And yeah. Taiwan is in a position very difficult to defend, whether for by the Taiwanese forces or even by the U.S. forces, right? Because it's such an island, a small island off the coast of, away from the mainland.
Yeah, 80 miles away, right?
Yeah. So if Chinese forces decided to cross the strait to invade Taiwan, I think Taiwan needs to really have those weapons that can fend off the Taiwanese Chinese attacks. So we are talking about, for example, F-16s will be very helpful in defending Taiwan, but these large items, it's very hard. It takes a long time to deliver.
I mean, are we talking about missile systems or what?
Yeah, defense missile system. For example, tanks would not be, very helpful in that scenario.
I think
it's the best strategy for Taiwan to defend is to think about turning Taiwan into a porcupine, where it's very, so anywhere you want to touch, it's going to hurt your hand. Taiwan is not there yet. I think that the asymmetric weapons, all these supplies, will be basically for defense rather than offensive purposes.
Okay, now you're the expert, I'm not, but Dr. Zhang, this kind of reminds me of Ukraine, because you had Russia putting troops on Ukraine's border for one year before its invasion. And if the Biden administration has said, well, we should probably send some arms there so the Ukrainians can push back should Russia decide to invade. And in fact, that was a question for about a year, and the Biden administration did nothing. And then once Russia invaded, then all of a sudden we start sending things in. And are we going to be a day late and a dollar short on Taiwan in the same way? Not give them the weapons they need right now to defend themselves, but once China starts attacking them, say, oh, by the way, we're going to get you what you need right now, which might have stood off the attack if it had come earlier.
Well, part of that, I think you're right, Lars, in pointing that out, because part of that was the intelligence failure. I think many in the West were not convinced that Putin was really going to invade Ukraine up to the very last moment. And so some of the preparation was really started when people started to believe that. And we run into the same problem with Taiwan all the time because, is China really going to invade Taiwan? It's going to be disastrous economically to the mainland. So sure, they probably would not do it. A lot of people think about it that way for years, right? And so, but now I think more and more people are more and more aware. Military and intelligence leaders came out frequently to say that Beijing really has the intention to take back Taiwan and not have them here. So I hope these sober comments.
I hope that's the direction they go. That's Dr. Weifeng Zhang. No, you.
Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me give you an update on the Donald Trump criminal trial in New York City. The jury has gone home for the night. Now, I can't remember if they're sequestered or not. I suspect they might not be because I haven't heard anything about them being sequestered. But in any case, the jury has gone home for the evening at being near 5 o'clock on the East Coast, and they have made no decision. Now, let me give you a couple of thoughts on that. I'm not a lawyer. I've sat in a lot of trials, but I'm not a lawyer. And I think the longer the deliberations go on, the more we blow a couple of things out of the water. Number one, the conventional wisdom has been, well, Donald Trump is on trial in New York City. And New York City is a notoriously super majority of Democrats, 80, 85, 90% voter registration. The last time I checked, I think Biden got like 85 or 90% of the vote in the last presidential election in New York State and also in New York City. So you have a jury. And also, as mentioned by one of my guests yesterday, who looked at it a lot more closely than I did, he said, you know, MSNBC has maybe 3 or 4% of the audience for cable news, because MSNBC is notoriously far to the left. And yet in the jury questionnaires, one third of that jury, 33% of that jury, are people who say their primary source of information is watching MSNBC, which is like admitting that you are a full blown all the way to the left person. So the usual conventional wisdom is that it is good news for the defendant, in this case Donald Trump, if the jury deliberations go on for quite a time, because if you assumed that a New York City jury full of Democrats, MSNBC watchers, voted for Joe Biden, hate Donald Trump with a passion, are put on a jury, they will fairly quickly come to the conclusion that he's guilty of anything the prosecutor accused him of. If that were the case, I think they would have made a decision already. I don't have never having served on a jury. I'd love to be on a jury, but I don't think most defense attorneys would allow me to stay on a jury of any consequence. But I still look forward someday to doing my jury duty. But in this case, if that jury didn't come to a conclusion in 5 hours on three crimes, there are 34 indictments, but there are three basic crimes, and the judge instructed the jury, you have to find, if you find him guilty, you don't have to all agree. This is the craziest part. You don't have to all agree on what crime he is guilty of. But if you all agree he's guilty of one of those crimes, then that becomes the felony. Because as you remember, if this were just the state misdemeanor of falsifying business records, the statute of limitations on that literally ran out 5 years ago. So he couldn't just be charged with falsifying business records. But what he is charged with conspiracy is not charged either, but planning to commit a federal election law violation. That's the felony. And then you might say, well, how is the New York DA charging a federal crime? He's not allowed to do that. No, he's not. And it's one of the many reasons that Donald Trump would likely win this one on appeal. But I have a feeling at this point, if that jury walked into the jury room, they had lunch, they sat down, they talked about the issues, they might have taken a straw poll to decide how many of us think he's already guilty. And after 5 hours of deliberations, they have now asked for a readback of some of the testimony of Michael Cohen and one other witness. If they haven't come to the conclusion in 5 hours, I think that's very good news for Donald Trump. Now, the side question might be this. If Donald Trump gets a not guilty finding from that jury and can never be charged with those crimes again by Alvin Bragg, so we've had one case in which he was convicted in a felony fraud case and ordered to put $500 million up in bail. He ended up putting up $175 million, and it was a fraud case where nobody was defrauded, nobody lost money. The purported victims were people who said, we'd be happy to do business with him again. So that's the kind of fraud case that was. Then you've got this case. If it ends in a not guilty finding, can you imagine the explosion that is likely to happen in major American cities? Think back to the summer of 2020. Think back to when they used George Floyd, not exactly a hero to Americans, although apparently to the left he's a hero. They keep having memorial ceremonies and other things where they laud him as this great American. He was a drug addict and a criminal, and he shouldn't have died the way he died, but he shouldn't have also sparked, or his death should not have sparked, the kind of riots and looting and mayhem and even murder that it actually sparked in America. So can you imagine the kind of explosion the left is going to have when their favorite latest criminal case against Donald Trump comes out with a not guilty finding? I don't know if the jury may walk in tomorrow morning, talk for 10 minutes and make a decision, or they could be locked up in there for days. But I think the more time that goes by, the better it is for Donald Trump. So latest word from New York City, The jury in the Donald Trump criminal case has now gone home or left the courtroom, courthouse for the evening. We assume they'll be back tomorrow to deliberate some more, and more time is going to go by. I think that's great news for Donald Trump. It may be sad news for America, because I think the kind of explosion of hate that is going to come if the liberals do not get a guilty finding on Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the case in Atlanta has fallen apart. The case with Jack Smith on the classified documents, that one has fallen apart, or it appears to be falling apart. Bad news all the way around, and the polls show Joe Biden is already going to lose, and his party is in a panic right now, as you can well understand. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your calls. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's my pleasure to be with you for some honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. Glad to be with you, and glad to take your calls as well at 866-HEY-LARS. You wonder, how much do American liberals and progressives hate Jewish people? Well, I thought I'd talk to a Jewish person about it. Ari Hoffman, host of the Ari Hoffman Show on our Seattle affiliate, KVI, whose show follows mine. Ari, how are you?
I'm great, buddy. How you doing?
I'm doing well, but how much do these, when I say liberals, I'm assuming that most of the people who work in the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle are probably not voting for Donald Trump this fall, and they probably didn't vote for conservatives and won't vote for conservatives. Why'd they walk off the job about, what was it, a week ago or so?
You know how they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions? So yes. What happened was the Wing Luke Museum teamed up with a black organization about civil rights and the Washington State Jewish Historical Society. And they created this exhibit where they were talking about racism that each of these communities have faced in Seattle and across the country and, you know, in other parts of their history. And what happened was the staff walked out because they were mad that the exhibit rightfully equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, specifically talking about a synagogue that had been vandalized in the wake of the October 7th attacks with anti-Semitic and anti-Israel messaging all over it. I mean, they hit this thing hard. They climbed on the roof. It was really, really bad. And these workers at this museum think it's wrong to call out hate that they disagree with. So they are so anti-racist that they are now deciding what is actually racism. And think about this, Lars. If somebody who's white, like us, tried to show somebody in the black community how we define racism for them, there would be national outrage over this. But here, instead what happened is these lefties gave away the game. Because they're saying, oh, we want to be anti-racist, but not for you Jews, not for you blacks, not for you Asians, because we disagree with what you're saying.
And I imagine there's somewhat of an economic element in it as well, because white people do better generally in America than people of color, and Jewish people do better than non-Jewish people economically. I don't think I'm talking out of my hat, you know, on that, because that's true. And now, what is the reason for it? Lots of reasons behind it, but some of this is economic envy or what?
I think what it is for the left, on the intersectional left, they have these systems of oppression. You fall into one of two classes, an oppressor or oppressed. And they feel, and this is the most racist thing of all, they feel that by the color of your skin, you must be oppressed. And if you're successful, that makes you oppressor, which is how certain people in the black community can use pretty horrible words to describe people who vote Republican who happen to have black skin. Same thing in other communities as well. So if you don't fit that oppressed, oppressor mindset, they lose their minds. Jews are 0.1% of the world's population, one of the ultimate minorities. I think the only racial group or ethnic group that has a smaller number than Jews is Armenians. But yet Jews don't get a box anywhere on any forms, nor do we want one, because we don't want affirmative action or any of that kind of garbage. But yet they don't consider us a minority. for us, they consider us oppressors because we have made a success for ourselves in this country.
And by the way, you're not oppressed, even though I think as a people, haven't you been kicked out of an awful lot of places over the last few millennia?
Yes, I think it's, about 100 countries.
I'm not just talking about the Holocaust. I'm talking about, I'm talking about the Romans. I'm talking about the diaspora and all kinds of things like that. I think you could argue, that was oppression against Jewish people because they were Jewish people, right?
There's a great book by Dara Horn called People Love Dead Jews. I mean, it's a great book to read, but if you have it out on the subway, people are going to judge you. But basically, it shows that the Democrats only really like Jews when they can make a case out of them. For example, in Pittsburgh, at the Tree of Life shooting, when it was an actual white supremacist who did that, they were all over it. But now when you're talking about the hatred coming from the far left, from Rashida Tlaib, from Ilhan Omar, from the college campuses, most of them are silent. Most of them don't want to say anything at all about it. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to discuss it, which shows that they just want to use the Jews for whatever their political purposes are.
And it's an element of the elite. In fact, Ari, I'll presage this. My next segment, I'm going to talk about the fact, why do working class college students don't do the campus protests, but the very elite, very expensive colleges have them? And I've got some numbers to back it up. Turns out there's a real pattern there. It has to do with Pell Grants and a lot of other things. But at the end of the day, do you think most of the people who talk about and disparage Zionism know what it is?
No, they have no clue whatsoever. Like, here's an example. They always say it has nothing to do with Judaism. Anybody who says that doesn't know anything about Judaism. At the end of the Passover Seder, at the end of the Yom Kippur Davening, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar, both of those say, next year in Jerusalem. It's throughout all our prayers, returning to Jerusalem, returning to Zion. So anybody who says, Barack Obama and his crew even paraphrased it when they were having their Seder before they went to the White House. They said, next year in the White House. I mean, even they knew what was at the end of that Seder. So these guys, whoever says that anti-Zionism isn't anti-Semitism has no idea what Judaism is actually about, and they should try cracking a book. What cracked me up are those Jewish Voices for Peace who aren't Jewish and don't want peace and actually have a lot of ties to terrorist organizations. They created a mat for Passover during the Columbia protest, and all the Hebrew was printed backwards. Show me again how you're not actually Jewish if you don't know Hebrew goes the opposite direction.
Well, and try this. For those people who say, hey, we've got Native Americans here. They would like to have their cultural, they'd like to have their ancestral lands back. Okay, we can do some of that. Can you have your ancestral practices, fishing and hunting and those things? We'd like to have those. Why? Well, because we did them for thousands of years, we'd like them back. I mean, is there really a dime's worth of difference between those two ideas of saying, well, these were historically their lands. Okay, they get them back. Now when they start asking for cash, I think the motivation may be something other than getting them back. But this is something the left loves, where the UW tells professors they have to go out and say, we acknowledge that we stole these lands. We're not giving them back, but we have to at least acknowledge we stole them, which I think is goofy and all that. But that's a nod towards saying, these lands used to belong to these people, and they should have them back, or at least acknowledge that they were taken. And yet when it comes to Israel, it's like, no, different set of rules, right?
Yeah, that's the irony with this. They said it's about colonialism, this exhibit, and white supremacy, an exhibit about blacks and Asians and Jews. Colonialism, by the way, Israel's the most successful decolonization movement ever in history. In fact, a lot of Native American activists look at how Jews got back Israel and talk about how they wish they could be that successful. And yet you have these Looney Tunes doing land acknowledgments on land they're occupying, claiming is occupied so they can occupy it to unoccupy Israel on these college campuses. The irony is insane.
It is crazy. Ari, thanks very much. I appreciate the time, and good luck on your show. I'll warm people up.
Thanks, buddy. Always a pleasure.
That is Ari Hoffman from our Seattle affiliate, KVI. Glad to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. Have you noticed the pattern that when you see these massive encampments on college campuses, they tend to involve a lot of non-students of those very colleges, in some cases even a majority of non-college students? But why are they not happening on the college campuses where working class college students are going to school? We'll talk about that coming up next, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866 Hey Lars. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you've been wondering out loud why it is that there are all these kids, young men and women who go to college, and they are some of the most elite, at least privileged, kids in America, because they don't have to go off and find a job somewhere. They get to spend 4 years or 6 years or maybe even 8 years pursuing a degree of some kind. Now, we can only hope that most of them are trying to get a degree that actually leads to a real job that does not involve pouring coffee. But then you notice that there are all these crazy campus protests, and they're obnoxious. They end up causing, in some cases, millions of dollars of damage to the campus where some of these young men and women go to school. And then we find out that in some cases, a majority of the so-called protesters, campus protesters, aren't even students on the campus at all. They're just there for the party. Now, I think I have an answer to part of this as to how it is and why it is and who it is that are staging these protests. Now, I know that many of them are aided and abetted by the efforts of the evil billionaire George Soros. But there's another element to this. The working class students don't do it. The elite kids do, which means, in short form, the more expensive the college is, like Columbia and Harvard, the more likely there is to be mayhem on campus. And that is the conclusion, and I'll give credit where it's due, to Washington Monthly and two great writers, Mark Novikoff and Robert Kelchin. And they did the research, and I was really impressed because they put something together I hadn't even thought of, and I want to share some of that with you. First, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with me for a little honestly provocative talk radio. If you want to join the conversation, it's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you disagree with my point of view or what I say, we're glad to have you on the show and put you first in line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. You'll find the brand new question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. That's formerly Twitter, and also on our website at LarsLarson.com. But this Washington Monthly piece, I really thought this was brilliant. They decided to look at what are called Pell Grants. Now, Pell Grants are awarded to students from moderate and low-income families so that they can go off to college. Now, you can debate whether or not such grants should be given, but they are. And what that means is an awful lot of the most elite of these college campuses, like Columbia and Harvard and Yale and all that, they don't have a lot of Pell Grant kids. And why? Because their families make too much money, which means they don't qualify for Pell Grants. And what Washington Monthly did was they used a bunch of data that's out there. One of them is called the Crowd Counting Consortium. That's data about where these encampments are. It's data about the students involved. And they match that information at every single institute of higher education, colleges and universities that have had pro-Palestinian Hamas protest activity ever since the war broke out in October. To colleges, and then they check that against the college rankings. 1,421 public and private nonprofit colleges that were ranked, 318 of them have had protests, 123 of them have had encampments. Now, they match this up, and they say, how much of this is happening in the most expensive colleges in America? The ones where it costs, I kid you not, tuition and a loan, not books, not fees, not cost of living on campus or whatever, but just tuition can be $70,000, $80,000, or $90,000 a year, which means a four-year degree with all costs included could easily cost more than $500,000. Those are the elite colleges, so-called, although these days having a diploma from one of those places may not actually get you a job with a big company, because they look at this kind of activity and they don't think well of it. So what did they come to the conclusion of? Pro-Palestinian protests have been rare at colleges with high percentages of Pell students from working-class families in America. Encampments at colleges have been rarer still. Now, there were a few. Cal State Los Angeles, City College of New York, and Rutgers University in Newark. But in the vast majority of cases, the campuses that educate students mostly from working class backgrounds haven't had any protest activity at all. And you know one great example from that? The HBCUs. That's the historically black colleges and universities. 64% of their students on average get Pell Grants. And yet when Washington Monthly went out and looked, the data shows that not a single one of the HBCUs have had encampments, and only nine have had protests. That is significantly lower than the non-HBCUs colleges. And why is that important? What it's saying to me is that if you are from the elite, if mom and dad have a pile of money and you go to a college where it's going to cost you $500,000 to get a four-year degree and a whole lot more than that if you're going for a master's degree or a PhD. So they decided to check this hypothesis. Have pro-Palestinian protests, meaning to me pro-terrorism protests, taken place disproportionately at elite colleges where very few students come from low-income families? And the answer they found, they call it a resounding yes. They use the percentage of students on Pell Grants as a proxy for low- to middle-income students. If you're from a rich family, you can't get a Pell Grant. If you're from a poor or middle-class family, you need that Pell Grant to be able to go to college. So that's what they found. 78 of the historically black colleges and universities on the list, 64% of the kids, almost two-thirds of them, get Pell Grants, and they've had almost no protest activity at all. Now, what does that tell you about what's going on? What's going on is a lot of very wealthy kids from affluent families have had the extra time not to focus on what they're trying to learn at college. They don't have to worry about that. Mom and dad have a pile of dough back at home. They're there mostly as a place to park 18 to 22-year-olds, so they're out of mom and dad's hair. And mom and dad are happy to pay tens of thousands of dollars, even hundreds of thousands of dollars, to get these kids out of the house. They'll be causing trouble at the campus instead of causing trouble at home. And then once they get there, do they have to take their studies seriously? Nah, not so much. They know they're going to have a future ahead of them. They're just expected to go to college because you can't very well tell mom and dad's wealthy friends, well, my son didn't go to college, didn't get a degree, or my daughter doesn't have a degree, wasn't smart enough to get into college. With enough money, you can get almost anybody into college. And then once you're there, as long as you adopt sort of the right political point of view, in other words, you're in favor of all the right things. You're against all the right things. You don't say a word about Donald Trump. You always say that Joe Biden is doing a great job. In that case, as long as you go along and get along with the professors who are almost uniformly left-wing Marxists, then you're going to come away with decent grades, a college diploma, and probably a trip or at least a route to a job of some kind. On the other hand, the working class kids, they understand this is their shot to be able to get things done. They know that mom and dad are sitting at home making sacrifices so that they can go to college, and they're going to take it seriously. So no protests, no encampments, no problem. Anyway, just something I wanted to share with you where you've actually got proof that this is largely an elite thing, you know, where they're out there saying, oh, we're in favor of the dispossessed. We're in favor of those people who are oppressed. We're assuaging our white guilt. Because most of the kids are white, by the way. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's... political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the things I love best about progressives when it comes to taxes is that they're convinced that every single dime that you make and I make and everybody else in America earns with our work belongs to the government, except the amount that they agreed to let us keep. Not the other way around, where we make our income and then pay, let's hope, a relatively small amount of money in taxes to fund the government for all the necessary things the government does and not all the unnecessary government things that our government tends to do. I thought of that when I took a look at the latest numbers that I got from Grover Norquist, who joins me now, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you.
I've gotten tired over the last 4 years of hearing how much the tax cuts cost the government, because it's all predicated on this idea that the government owns all of my money and your money and everybody else's money except what they deign to let us keep, and that when they are forced to lower tax rates in any way whatsoever, that costs them money, as though it belonged to them already and they had to agree to give some of the government's money back to me, the actual person who earned the money. And they said, well, you know, these Trump tax cuts, they cost a ton of money. They cost $1 trillion. And we find out now when we look at the actual numbers, none of that is true, don't we?
Yes, but to your point, you really learn almost everything you need to know about a politician when they start talking as you did. Do they refer to taxes as something that costs you, as an expense, as an outgo, as a burden? Or do they refer to tax cuts as giving somebody money? Okay. they cut taxes on Fred. They gave him money. That tells you, as you just outlined, whether they believe the government owns it all or could or should own it all if they wanted to, or whether it's your income, your property, your house, your work that's being part of it's being taken by the government. It lets you know where they stand. Do they stand with the government? Well, this is an expensive tax cut. Or do they stand with people? This is a great tax cut. This is an expensive tax increase, would be expensive to taxpayers. Do they look around and see taxpayers as their constituency or tax eaters, people who profit off of government spending, like themselves, kind of, because they're on the payroll to start with.
Well, it's funny too, because Grover, I've complained to my colleagues in the press. I was a reporter for a couple of decades, and when they'd say, "Why this latest cut is going to cost to the government so and such," I thought, "Hold on, you, the reporter, are you representing the public or are you representing the government? If you're representing the government, you say tax cuts cost the government. If you're representing the public, the general public that is supposed to be served by government, you say this tax cut will benefit the taxpayers by giving them some more of their money back, by letting them keep more of the money that they earned. The government didn't earn it and doesn't earn it, but the taxpayers do earn it, and then they give up a portion of it to the government, allegedly for services that many of us never ever see."
And the reporter says, "You know what? When the American taxpayer starts giving me leaks and information I can write columns on, I'll look at them as my employer. But right now, I make my living getting leaks and handout information from the government, from government workers, from politicians. So I serve their interests so they will give me things to write about, so I will have a paycheck, so I will be important." Taxpayers can't compete with the fact that these people regularly, their careers, most press people's careers, are built on favors from the government. I will tell you this first, then you will be famous, then you will get a raise, and you will be a great reporter. What's that mean? You took dictation from the government, and the government gave you the information the government had, because the government says we're going to do this on Tuesday, and you reported it.
And anybody who can connect two dots with a crayon on a piece of construction paper can figure out why are so many people working as spokespeople within the government for a big fat federal or state paycheck who used to be reporters? Well, because it pays well and you almost can't get fired. Let me go to the, because that's another promise that comes with it. You say, gee, should I go out and badmouth the government when I might actually find a career after press, after radio, after TV, after media? I can find a job working as a press secretary for an elected member of Congress or a federal or state agency. Let's go to the actual collections, because if you don't mind, if I talk the way the liberals talk and say, did this tax cut that was passed by the Congress, signed by President Trump, all this money, did it actually cost the government money or did it put more money in the Treasury?
Well, revenues have continued to go up. The corporate tax cut, which was supposed to cost X amount, actually, corporate revenues continued to go up.
almost as much as they planned to without the tax increase. They certainly went up, okay? Revenues went up at all levels, and we saw extra growth, more people working in 2019, the first full year of the tax cut. You saw the second full year of the tax cut. You saw the median income go up by 6.8%, median, the absolute middle family in the whole country. And that means tens of millions of people saw significant increase, 6.8%. In 1 year, that's more increase in the family's income than all 8 years of Obama produced, okay? And, of course, most Americans are behind under Biden. They're making, after inflation, if you count inflation and you're counting real money here, most Americans are making less than they did before. You may got it, unless you got a pay raise of more than 18%, you lost money because the value of your dollar went down by 18% thanks to Biden's inflation. So no, the idea tax lower taxes gives you economic growth. And we've seen this in states which reduce their taxes, and you see revenue come in. And North Carolina's been phasing out its income tax to zero over the last 12 years. Every year they cut the income tax a little bit. Every year revenue goes up. Why? Because people move there, because there are more jobs, because they're better paying jobs, because there's more investment in North Carolina. When they raise taxes in quite a number of these states, they don't end up with the revenue. Because people, there's this wonderful headline, somebody whining, they passed a tax on expensive houses being sold. And they said, you know, in California, they're cheating the taxpayer because they're not selling their houses because we put this very high tax on expensive houses. You know, you were supposed to not change your behavior when the government decided to tax something. They get surprised by that. Yeah, and the same thing happens with work. When Reagan cut taxes, when the Republicans cut taxes under Trump, if you can earn more money by working on Saturday because taxes are lower, more people work on Saturdays. And that creates more wealth and income in the whole country.
By the way, I've got less than a minute, but we got lied to when it came to the 50,000 tax files that were stolen by a thief.
Yes.
Right? Now tell my audience quickly.
Okay. There was a guy who worked for the IRS who said, I went there for years. He went through and stole data. The government said, oh, thousands. They now acknowledge somewhere between 50 and 70,000 people, including, by the way, Tiger Woods, Taylor Swift, Oprah Winfrey, LeBron James, had their taxes stolen, given to a left-wing group called ProPublica, and who knows what they're doing with it in terms of blackmailing people. But this is all stolen. The guy who got arrested for it said he worked by himself. I'm not sure I believe that for some.
And he got prosecuted for exactly one theft, 5 years in prison. Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thank you.
Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. Our X poll today. Should government-run schools in the Pacific Northwest instruct students about Palestine as the teachers' unions plan to do? I'd say no to that. You can answer any way you like, and you can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X, which used to be Twitter. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And I might say shame on the teachers' unions for saying we're going to deliberately politicize the kids that are being taught. You're not teaching them how to read, write, or do math. You're doing a lousy job at that, but you want to teach them all about Palestine when most of them couldn't find it on a map and don't know what the river is that they're talking about when they say from the river to the sea, nor do they know the hidden and genocidal meaning of that sentence, from the river to the sea. Yesterday's poll, closing arguments yesterday, will a New York City jury find President Trump guilty? Well, they went home tonight after 5 hours of deliberation with no decision. Apparently, the Trump team is now smiling, and the prosecution team looks nervous. So, will the jury find President Trump guilty? I said no. They're not going to. Yeah, you, 56% of you said yes. Only 44% said no. So kind of a split decision. Let's go to Armin, calling in from Maury Island and listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Armin, what's on your mind?
I wanted to put in a word for engineering majors opposing these student protests. Back in 1968, I was an engineering major at Rutgers University in the main campus in New Brunswick. And we had the school was shut down for 3 days. It came a week or two, as I recall, it's been a long time, after the protests at Columbia, where the students had taken over the office of the president. I think it was the very same office they did this last time around. Well, anyway, the school was shut down for 3 days. As I said, I was in the College of Engineering at the time. And we engineers had no interest in these student protests. And when classes resumed, our professors announced we were going to make up the lost time. And so for the next several weeks, or until the end of the semester, I think we're getting near the end of the semester, they added anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes, depending on, you know, it was like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday we lost. And if you had a class that was on Monday and Wednesday, we might have lost 3 hours of education if it met on those days. And it's, you're going to make up that time. And so we had, our classes were extended. So some of our classes started at 8 in the morning, which was pretty early for a college student. And they started maybe at 7:30 or quarter of 8 until, you know, we had made up all those minutes. So that was, I just want to draw this contrast between how some majors and the professors treated this whole thing versus others. We didn't get a free ride out of it whatsoever. And the time was made up. Those professors were serious about the education we were getting, and they wanted to be sure that we covered all the material. Anyway,
well, and doesn't that make sense, Armin? Because I look, I liked school. I liked high school. I liked the bit of college I did. I didn't finish, but I enjoyed it. And I thought I got a lot out of it, and I enjoyed learning things. I know that a lot of kids today will tell you that school's a chore. It's something they have to go do. I wish we could turn it into something they want to do, because it'll be the cheapest education you get any time in your life. After you exit high school, you got to pay for it beyond there. And you may have to pay for it by working in a business and learning that way. And that's one way to pay for it. You may have to pay for it with tuition and things like that. But when your college professor said, if we promise to give a certain amount of education, we're going to deliver what we promised. Whereas it sounds like an awful lot of these people have been camped out for weeks or even months on college campuses. They have nothing better to do. They apparently don't care about their studies, or their studies are so darned easy. You know, if they're studying underwater left-handed basket weaving, okay, maybe you don't have to show up for class every day to get a pass at the end of the term. But it kind of suggests if it's that easy to do it, engineering's hard. It's got a lot of math, a lot of science, and if you don't do it, then you're not going to be very good at your job. And it suggests something to me about all the people who are involved in these protests, that somebody else is paying the tab. If my mom and dad had had the ability to pay the amount of money that some of these kids are paying, $70,000, $80,000, even $90,000 a year for tuition,
and then you
told them, by the way, I skipped the last several weeks of classes that mom and dad had paid for, they'd have my hide.
Speaking of money, if I've got another 30 seconds, when I went to Rutgers, 64 through 69, I went through a 5-year double degree program, tuition for the entire 5 years was $200 a semester, plus there was like a student fee of $43 or something. So it was like $500 a year. I don't know what Rutgers costs now. At the time, I wanted to go to one of the little Ivy League schools, and they were like $2,000 a year. There was no way my parents had the money for $2,000 a year. Rutgers still is the state university. So those schools that were then $2,000 are now, like you say, $60,000 to $90,000. Rutgers is probably $8,000 or $10,000 a year now.
Well, no, it's actually, if you're a Jersey resident, it's $13,600 a year. If you're non-New Jersey, then it's $32,000 if you commute there. And if you're on-campus students, almost $36,000 a year to go to that university. And that's a tremendous amount of money to pay, except that to a certain extent, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the college kids are saying, yeah, I signed the paper, I borrowed the money, but I'm never going to pay it back. Nobody pays their loans back. When you create that as the new norm in America, where you can borrow tens of thousands of dollars, spend it on what turns out to be a worthless education, and then say, but I don't have to pay it back, you're really breeding a disrespectful and dishonest society. Armin, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. The Lord.